Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello there. No rhyme at the top of this show because this is a special episode where we step back and take a wider look at what was going on at the time of the regular podcast with a special guest. And as we're in the Georgian era, and as one of my other hats is that of a comedian, as well as a very occasional cartoonist, I thought it would be fun to look at this period of history through the lens of satire, specifically the popular engravings from the time, which can be seen as very much the birth of the newspaper political cartoon. And my guest on this episode is a history broadcaster and writer who I first met last summer at the Chalk Valley History Festival when she was a panellist on the light-hearted history quiz that I host there called Histrionics. She is Alice Loxton, and you may be familiar with her because she used to be the lead female presenter at History Hit TV, where she also regularly presented documentaries with Dan Snow, one of my regular team captains on Histrionics. Alice also shares her passion for history with something like 2 million followers on TikTok and Instagram. And you can tell from that last bit that Alice is a lot younger than me and knows how to do these things. But the main reason I have Alice on today is because she is the author of the very popular book Uproar, Satire, Scandal and Printmakers in Georgian London, which follows the stories of three printmakers in particular through this period, Thomas Rowlandson, James Gilray and Isaac Cruikshank. And the paperback of Uproar is published mid-March 2024. It's a hugely entertaining book. It's a, well, I hesitate to use the word romp, but it seems an appropriate word to use when you look at the amount of romping going on in these scurrilous, bawdy, fecund and earthy engravings. All human life is there. So, Alice, welcome onto the show. It seems like ages ago. Well, it was ages ago. It was last summer when I talked to you about possibly doing the podcast. And we finally got around to the Georgians. So it's great to have you on and to see you again.
No, thanks so much for having me. I'm so excited to finally be here. What an honour.
But you've obviously done a lot of podcasting and kind of engaged with the world through social media. And, you know, you obviously have a massive love of history and particularly a massive love of sharing that with people.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I've worked in all sorts of different formats. I've worked making documentaries, editing podcasts, producing podcasts, now on social media, a lot of stuff on TikTok and Instagram where I just make these very short little history videos. But yeah, I mean, it's just a great passion of mine, I suppose, both creating the content, the video content, the audio content, but also the history. So it's bringing those two things together.
I mean, it must take up a huge amount of your time. You know, people sometimes assume, oh, podcasts, you just sit down and talk for an hour and stick it out. But actually, if you're doing something factual and not just two blokes down the pub talking, a lot of work goes into it. And, you know, I see the stuff you post online and you seem to be all over the country doing things. I mean, the great thing about Britain, I suppose, is wherever you are, there's always some bit of history you can talk about.
Exactly. I mean, wherever I go, even if I'm just going to stay with a friend for a weekend, wherever it is in the country, I can definitely make a video, which is really exciting. But you're right, you know, making podcasts, making content, making social media content, even if it's just a few seconds long, you know, that's the kind of experience people have, that it's very quick and a few seconds long. But actually, it takes a huge amount of time to make it all. So I do appreciate anyone who's a podcaster out there. It's a tough gig.
But somebody has to do it. But I'm so impressed, Alice, that with all the other stuff you do, you found the time to research and write Uproar. But let's get back to where it all began. I'm assuming you did history at university. So how did that lead you to your subject, these fabulous Georgian printmakers?
Yes, so I did history at uni. I went to Edinburgh, which was amazing. And it was actually whilst I was at Edinburgh University. And these prints, these images, they always use them as illustrative devices when you're teaching the 18th century. Anything about Napoleon, they'll always use these pictures. And so I was very familiar with them. And we spent all this time looking at these prints. But actually, we never really completely focused in on, say, James Gilray as an artist. He was always used as this kind of side note, this illustrative device for a much bigger picture. And anyway, I sort of was writing about Gilray in my dissertation. And I remember standing in the Waterstones in Edinburgh on Prince's Street and looking at all the books and just thinking about how I'd never really come across a book that was kind of devoted to their story. And then I thought maybe I should write the book. So I did. And, you know, I'd like to caveat that with saying that there are some really good books out there that are about this topic. But, you know, I've tried to write it in a way that's really, really, really easy to read. You don't need to know anything about who George III is. You don't need to know anything about history. And it's got some light touches in, which hopefully bring it out to a wider audience.
Yeah, and it's very interesting what you're saying about them being a historical source. And they are an amazing source for what people kind of looked like, what they wore, how they behaved, right from the top echelon society, right down to the bottom. And as someone who's only just now really going into the history and politics of the time, I can appreciate the pictures of Georgian life they give us, but I often have no idea, well, what the joke is or who these politicians are. What did they do? I guess political cartooning can only ever be quite a sort of ephemeral thing.
Well, if you think about cartoons that we have in the newspapers today, every single day there's a cartoon, and it's a joke that is related to the day's news. You know, it's out of date the next day because there's another cartoon. And so if you think about how niche those references must be, and then if you're looking at a cartoon or a print from, say, 1805, and you're trying to dissect them, and they're far more complicated, the prints from the 18th and 19th centuries. So I think there's lots of jokes in these prints that we probably have no idea about ourselves, and we'll never know, just because, you know, why would we? But yeah, it doesn't surprise me if people find them very complicated. But actually, what's so exciting about them is they've got all these clues in there, and it's unravelling these clues, it's finding the jokes that makes them so interesting and fun to look at.
Now, I briefly touched on this in a previous episode, that Britain had put in place the Licensing of the Press Act in 1662 to regulate the printing industry, but it expired in 1695 and wasn't renewed, largely due to pressure from liberal politicians, which meant that we had relative freedom of the press. And politicians basically, I mean, they saw it was a good thing to pander to public tastes and give them what they wanted, which was a good laugh at the expense of government and the monarchy. And politicians could secretly feed stuff to their favourite cartoonists if it worked against their rivals. And this allowed the satirists like Rowlandson, Gilray and Cruikshank to flourish.
You are right. There's all these developments which kind of make it this wonderful moment to be creative and to say brazen things at the end of the 18th century. So, for example, visitors would visit London. Foreigners would visit London at the end of the 18th century, and they would be shocked at how much people could get away with. That on the street where the king would walk along, or the prince would walk along, or be in his carriage, these print shop windows would be outside the palace, really damning for the royal family. And the foreign visitors just couldn't believe that they were allowed to get away with it. And there was a certain freedom. There was a certain sense that, you know, in Britain, in London, you could be much freer with your words and you could be much freer with what you think. And you could express yourself more, you know, freedom of speech, that sort of thing. And there was a great sense of that. And I think you see that in these cartoons. And that's why you don't see them in other countries quite so much.
Was there a similar sort of blossoming of this type of technology and art in like France, for instance? But it sounds like not.
Well, it was more strict. This is a great generalisation, but it was stricter abroad. But I think the really key thing here is that there were, perhaps particularly Gilray, that he is a genius. He is individually a genius in that he was creating these amazing pieces of art. And I'm not just saying this as the person who wrote the book. I think he is one of the greatest artists in British history, and we never talk about him. I think he's far more creative than almost any artist that's ever been. You know, he's far more creative. He's just as skilled as Hogarth. He's just as inventive as Turner. He uses language in such an amazing way. He uses visual imagery in the most brilliant and creative way. And he makes these images which, even after 200 years of us becoming familiar with, you know, graphic design or Photoshop or all the weird adverts that, you know, the world can throw at us, that Hollywood can throw at us, even today they're still strange and they're still unnerving and they're still alluring. And I think that's a real testament to how brilliant he was. And, you know, if we still find them strange today, they must have been really shocking for people in London in the 1790s. And this was a period where people didn't see brightly coloured window displays in the same way that we might today. You know, they're not seeing these beautiful and incredible visual displays in whatever form. You know, all the time today we're bombarded with kind of amazing visuals, and they just didn't have that. This is a time when if there was a pub that had a new sign put outside, people would go and look at it because that's like the exciting thing to see. So, you know, you just have to think about these print shop windows. And it was described as veritable madness when the next print was put up. It was a kind of Beatlemania of the day. So it's a really exciting time.
So how did that work then? That whole system of creating the prints, displaying them and selling them. Talk us through that.
Yeah, it's a good question. And the person at the heart of it in this story is a woman called Hannah Humphrey. So she's quite cool. She's this like print shop owner. I think of her as the Simon Cowell kind of figure. She's running the operation, and then all these artists are the kind of starlets, you know, who are kind of get the name, but they're not actually doing the business. And so Hannah Humphrey would own her print shop. She would come up with the ideas, I think, with the artists. They knew each other very well. James Gilray lived with Hannah Humphrey. Perhaps there was a romantic relationship there. We're not really sure. And I think it's a bit like newspaper commissioners and editors and writers today. Say you have a columnist in a big newspaper, say The Times, and say there's the commissioning editor there. I mean, they might have a 30-year relationship where they're constantly talking about ideas and, you know, sometimes it's this person's idea, sometimes it's that. I think it's that sort of thing. And they would come up with these ideas together in the pub or in the shop itself. And all the print shops and all the places that these artists were living were all very, very close together. So they'd always be bumping into each other, always be going to each other's shops. So it's very fluid. And that makes it quite hard sometimes to work out who's come up with the idea. So they'd come up with the idea, and then it would be commissioned, and James Gilray would go away, and he would create this amazing, he'd etch into the copper plate, and then he'd print it.
They were doing the engravings themselves. They weren't having engravers copy their
It's a mixture. I mean, it really is a mixture. Right. But the original piece of art is basically the copper plate, which is then etched or engraved. That's the original piece. And then there'll be print runs of a few hundred different prints. But, you know, sometimes they were reprinted. The problem is that the metal plate gets clogged up. So you can't actually print that many from the original. But they would reprint them. And then they'd have other people to come in and colour them. So you see often lots of different prints of the same image, which are coloured differently because it's been done at different times.
They were editions of hundreds rather than thousands.
Yeah, hundreds, I'd say, yeah. But, you know, they'd be making new prints all the time. They could churn these out in very quickly, perhaps.
And they're displayed in the windows of these shops. And I mean, would the popular ones stay up for a long time?
Yeah.
So that everyone could have a look?
These are luxury items in some ways, that they're really beautifully produced. These artists have been trained at the Royal Academy schools alongside the likes of Reynolds. Mm. And they were very expensive to buy, but they basically served a dual purpose. some people would come into the print shops, they'd go in, there'd be wealthy customers, and Hannah Humphrey would look after them and schmooze them, you know, a bit like kind of designer shops today. I don't know, I've never been in, but that's how I imagine it is. You get to sit on a sofa and all that kind of stuff. And they could buy them and they'd take them home and they might put them in their big country houses. But then on another level, they became this really important propaganda tool because they were displayed in the print shop windows. And so ordinary people could also go and see the prints. And that was where the kind of hysteria would come in because they'd be displayed and it would attract all these vast crowds of people. So, you know, there's different prints for different purposes. I think there are so many. There's literally thousands and thousands of prints they produce that you have to know that there's like a real variety.
Yes, it's not only political cartooning. Yeah. I suppose there's sort of moral tales.
And just silly things about, people taking medicine and stuff. And it's like everything, literally everything.
So it's just sort of trying to reflect everything that was going on.
Yeah, I mean,
in the contemporary world, I guess.
Yeah, it's just all of the funny things that happen. I mean, there are some which really did change the world. They were big political images. For example, Napoleon, they created this myth that Napoleon was short, which is not true. And then that was at a time of great tension during the Napoleonic Wars. So, and there's, you know, there's images that would bring down politicians and all that kind of thing. But then there are images of just people in their ordinary lives, the follies and foibles of ordinary life, in the same way that people will make memes today about funny things that happen in their own lives.
It's a sort of mass media of the day.
Yeah, I mean, what was so good about them is that they could be very reactive. They could be printed very quickly, you know, unlike a painting, say. And they could be printed quite cheaply and there could be lots of them. And so when there was a big political scandal, like there's this scandal with the Duke of York in 1809, they printed so many.
Right, so this was when King George III's second son, Frederick, the Duke of York, resigned as commander-in-chief of the army after his mistress, Mary Ann Clark, was accused of secretly selling army commissions. They claimed she was taking money to basically make young aristocrats senior officers.
There's a whole booklet just dedicated to that scandal. So, you know, you can imagine all the jokes growing and growing and growing. And every day there's new funny material and it just keeps coming. Yeah, it's good fun.
And I mean, did the likes of Gilray work for newspapers as well? Were there similar cartoons or whatever in the newspapers?
Well, at this point in time, newspapers didn't have the imagery that we know today. Yeah. So that came a bit later with the Punch magazine, that kind of thing. So the generation of artists that I'm talking about, say 1780 to 1810, that was the era of the print shop window, right? So that is where the satires would have been presented. And there wasn't any other place, like a newspaper, say, where you would have these kind of cartoons. In fact, the word cartoon didn't even exist. And so it wasn't until a development of printing technology where you could literally just print newspapers, cheaper, double-sided, that they started to be able to put images and satires and cartoons in the newspapers. And then when that happens, the power of the print shop window dies out. So it loses its touch, if you like.
And did the Georgies try to suppress it at all? Or did they just think, we've let a few go and we're still sitting on the throne, so maybe they're not as much of a threat as...
Yeah, it's a really good question. And, you know, I said earlier about people thinking it was this amazing, formidable fortress of freedom in London. But there were moments where they were suppressed. So during the 1790s, when it was post kind of French revolutionary activity and the king being executed, there was this really difficult time in Britain for the prime minister not to give in to the revolutionary ideas in Britain, but also to be very hardline. And, you know, it was a very, very tense moment. And lots of the print sellers were suppressed at that point. Some of them went to prison. The problem is they all went to Newgate, and then it really created this great hub of revolutionary, you know, they're all talking about it together. So it didn't really work. But no, it's really interesting looking at the royals and the printmakers. So we know that there's this point where Prince George, who was the son of King George III and the future King George IV, we know that he commissioned prints as a propaganda to support his claim to become a prince regent. And that's during the regency crisis of 1789. And we only know about this because years later they were going through his accounts and there were all these secret payments going to the print sellers. And so then, of course, you have to look at lots of these prints and think, well, was it James Gilray who believed this? Is he doing it because he believes himself? Is he doing it because Hannah Humphrey's saying, just make this print because that's what the people want? Or is he being paid to do it by someone else? And it's really hard to know.
And was I right to say earlier that the politicians were doing the same thing, paying the printmakers to attack their opponents?
Yeah, there was a bit of that, and Gilray was definitely paid to create pro-government propaganda, if you like. But the thing is that they would make these images, you know, supporting Pitt, the Prime Minister, and sometimes you think, oh, well, that must have been paid for, but then a day later there will be one supporting someone else. So it's very fickle. I think it's a really, really hard thing to work out, and that's what lots of historians are discussing all the time. And the problem is that the prints are so complicated and there are so many of them, like literally thousands, that it's hard to get a good feel of all of them. So I'll leave that up to you, Charlie.
Yeah, if only I had the time. I've got to research a whole new bloody monarch every week. So, Alice, is there a major collection of these prints anywhere? Where's the best place to go if you want to have a look at them?
Yeah, well, I think... I mean, what's so good about them is they are just images. So you can just trawl through Google, which is really fun.
Right.
But the best kind of reliable historic place, if you were doing research, say, is the British Museum website. And they've got loads, and they've all got explanations, curators' comments, which dissect all the details. And you can zoom into all the images. It's actually an incredible resource. So I'd definitely recommend people go there. And it does pay off just to look at them. Just to take a few moments, because as you said earlier, they're, when you first look at them, you have no idea what's going on. But you can work it out, and that's really fun.
Did these artists leave much sort of personal evidence in terms of journals or letters or anything, or is it mainly just the images?
We do have some letters, some correspondence. It was interesting looking at the wills. I think what's interesting about these guys and girls, Hannah Humphrey, is that they are actually quite ordinary people. They're not really flashy, they're not really grand, but actually they are creating this revolution in art. They are revolutionising the way that we see the world. So basically there are a few records that people wrote about afterwards in hindsight. So it's kind of hard to know. But like, for example, there's one moment. So I said about James Gilray and Hannah Humphrey and whether there was a romantic interest. She's a lot older than him. And there is this one anecdote where they went to church together to get married. And then Gilray basically loses faith on the door, apparently, and just says, I think, you know, Mrs. Humphrey, we're happy enough as it is. Let's not spoil it. And then he runs home. And that's it. So a disappointed day out for Hannah, no doubt. But, you know, there's a few things like that, which are great fun, which I hope I bring out in the book, really. But you know what? The other thing is, it would be an amazing screenplay, and that has been discussed at various points. So maybe that's when it will really come to life.
Well, that would be fantastic. I mean, I've obviously had a few historians on whose books have been used as the official source for films, and quite a few, I must say, who were used as sources but never officially credited or paid. But it sounds like you're on top of all of that side of things. And from what you're saying, if it was down to you, I guess the hero of the film, the central character, would have to be Gilray. I think he's definitely your favourite. And on the cover of your book, Uproar, you have what is probably the best known print from this era, the famous image of the world as a plum pudding, with William Pitt the Younger and Napoleon Bonaparte slicing it up between them. And most contemporary political cartoonists, if you ask them to name the best and most influential political cartoon ever, would probably say it was this. I mean, it's an image that's been reprinted, reused, redone, repurposed so many times over the years, because there will always be powerful men trying to carve up the world for their own benefit.
You're right. And that's why I had to have it on the front, because I felt like that's probably what people recognise. It's really interesting how I often say to people, you know, people who've gone to universities to do history, people who know a lot about history, you know, people who you'd think would know about these guys. And I say, do you know James Gilray? They don't know often. But then if you show them a picture of the plum pudding image, they recognise it. And That's really interesting. And so, yeah, I really want to have that on the front. I think it's balanced by the book being pink. So it doesn't look too much like a military history book. This is definitely the most important image. The plum pudding in danger. And it's been reused again and again and again because it's depicting these two world leaders carving up the world. And it's basically this commentary on world power, global dominance, the greed of politicians, because this steaming pudding represents the globe, and Napoleon is slicing off this section which reads Europe, so that's reflecting his position in 1805, dominating Europe. Mm-hmm. But then Pitt has got this massive slice, which is much bigger, but it's basically
he's taking the entire Western Hemisphere.
The ocean. Yeah, he's got the ocean, and that's reflecting, right, like the British naval supremacy at the
right,
time.
Okay.
So you can read into it. But yeah, it's been replaced. I mean, the plum pudding has been replaced by all sorts of things. The AstraZeneca vaccine, the COVID virus, the figures, you know, every political figure has been sat in that position in the last few years. And it's been on the front of The Spectator. It's been used yeah, in The Guardian, and, you know, in every newspaper it's been used. And it's not just this image. It's many, many images that Gilray was making. So it's great fun to see it. Once you recognise them, you'll see them everywhere.
I find Gilray's caricature of Napoleon quite interesting. I mean, he always depicted him as this apoplectic, skinny little man wearing big boots and this vast feathered hat. And that became the sort of accepted caricature of Napoleon. It became very popular and instantly recognisable at the time. But it's not the caricature that we now recognise of Napoleon, which is pretty much how he looks on the poster for Ridley Scott's film of Napoleon. Stocky and brooding with one hand stuck inside that long grey coat and the very distinctive hat with the back turned up and flattened. I mean, I wonder when that caricature changed. And where did Gilray get his image of Napoleon from?
Well, it's interesting talking about Napoleon with Gilray, because Gilray's great strength was that he would see people in the flesh. He was sent out as a war reporter to go and sketch the battlefield. And, you know, he'd go to Parliament. And his big strength was, I can look at people and I can capture a likeness. And that's really effective with all the politicians. But with Napoleon, he never saw Napoleon. So the question is, how much can we rely on that? I don't know. But he creates this, basically, as tension grows in the Napoleonic War era, as Napoleon rises and becomes more and more of a threat to Britain, he creates this image with the other satirists of Napoleon basically getting shorter and shorter and having bigger tantrums and being this kind of tantrum-ridden toddler. And I think it's so funny because, you know, this is a man who's incredibly impressive, has conquers so many places in Europe, has crowned himself emperor in Notre Dame Cathedral, has done all these amazing things. The way that the satirists in London can bring him down is by this very, very personal thing of just saying that he's really short. You know, that's the most effective thing. And it does work, and it's still used today. I think if you ask people on the street, tell me something about Napoleon, they'd say he's French, which is not quite true. And they'd also say he's short, which is definitely not true. So people are actually seeing Napoleon through the lens of Gilray rather than the man himself. And that's just one example of the kind of impact that Gilray had that we're not aware of, or people generally aren't aware of.
It often takes satirists and cartoonists and impressionists to kind of cement the popular public yes, image of someone.
Yeah.
In the 1980s, the satirical TV show Spitting Image, which had these amazing puppets, these caricatures, it made characters out of Thatcher and her cabinet, where before many of them had just been faceless politicians. And politicians would feel that they hadn't made it until they'd become a puppet. And even the ones who were most vilified would always ask if they could buy their puppets. I mean, did the same sort of thing happen with the Georgian satirists?
There are examples of, say, Charles James Fox, who's one of the politicians that's always satired. And he would go into the print shop and be like, oh, look, there's loads of satires of me. How dare you? But also I'll buy a few. So I think they sort of felt that maybe it's a good thing, you know, at least you're being talked about, perhaps, is the
well,
idea.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, it better to be talked about and visible than just some
and actually,
non-entity.
There's one example of one politician who spends months really trying to contrive a meeting with Gilray. He does all this stuff like, oh, please, can you set me up with Gilray? Why don't we organise this thing where I could like drop off a painting and then I can just happen to talk to him? And he's so excited about it. And he's, you know, he writes letters the whole time, really trying to get in. And this is a politician on the make. And he's so disappointed when he goes to the window and he sees that he's not in it. And there's all these records of him falling about crying. And his maid has to like give him something like sweet cakes or something because he's so upset. And then eventually he does make a debut in a Gilray print. He's so overjoyed. But hilariously, the very first depiction of him is him. It's this like nightmarish scene in London, imagining if the French Revolution was here. So he's actually like swinging from a lamppost like a hanged man. So, you know, that's his like first moment. But obviously, he'd be overjoyed because you're a character, you're deemed a character worth talking about. So
I'm sure many lesser 1980s politicians would have been happy to appear hanging from a gibbet on Spitting Image.
The creators of Spitting Image said that they owed Gilray a royalty payment. That's how much they were kind of inspired by his work.
Yeah, I mean, they were so indebted to Gilray that they actually made a puppet of him. He appears as a royal flunky in some of the Buckingham Palace scenes, dressed in this kind of 18th century flunky's outfit. And that style of caricature that I guess Gilray perfected, and it's been used so much ever since, right through Spitting Image, right up to the present day. But that goes back to before the British satirists. I mean, I gather the history of the caricature, like so many ideas in art, started in Italy.
It was in the 18th century when tourists from Britain, so we call them the grand tourists, went over to Italy, and they were inspired by the art which was there, or at least they collected it. And they have all of these kind of images of the grand tourist type, so these kind of comical portraits, and they'd have exaggerated features, or, you know, for comic effect. And they started to bring these back to London because they were travelling back home. They became popular in London. There were these various different print shops that emerged over the 18th century. So it is something that develops in the 18th century. And it develops alongside kind of developments in Italian influence and fashion. In fact, there's one of the most popular print shops in London is called the, what's the pasta? It's what the young men who wore outrageous and extravagant clothes.
Do you mean the Macaronis?
Oh, Macaronis, that's it.
It was Macaronis. Macaronis, okay, we're called Macaronis.
Yeah, so the Macaronis. So, you know, there were so many prints created about the styles and the Macaroni fashions that you know, the great print shop in London became known as the Macaroni print shop. So there's a real Italian influence there. And then it builds up, and then it sets this scene for someone like Gilray or Rowlandson or Cruikshank to come along and really be perfectly positioned to make the most of it.
And so we're seeing the birth of what became known as the political cartoon. I mean, and as I said before, there are so many aspects of modern cartoons that we see in the 18th century. Speech bubbles, for instance.
Well, there are examples earlier, but they really, really use them all the time. They kind of normalise it, I suppose. You know, I mean, there are examples, I suppose, even in sacred Renaissance art, of people using even a kind of banner with text in. Right. So you could date things back to that. But I think using the kind of the speech bubble that we're familiar with comedy lines in, is something that they definitely lean into. Another thing is they developed this kind of format where there might be 8 different boxes on one page, which then tells a story. And that's obviously very similar to comic books that we have today. So perhaps that's another legacy. But I think when you look at cartoons today in the newspapers, you know, cartoonists today have all the tools available on an iPad, right? You know, or Photoshop, whatever. They could have any style. They could be inspired by any visual style at all. And yet they still are very similar to what the 18th century satirists were like. So they'll have black line outlines. They'll have quite spiky use of line. They'll have these big speech bubbles. They'll have a kind of accompanying bits of text at the bottom. The whole style of it is really similar. The word cartoon didn't actually exist in Gilray's time as we know it. So when Gilray was alive, the word cartoon meant a kind of preparatory sketch that would have been used in the same way as Renaissance artists for a fresco, perhaps.
Yes, I'm one of probably many thousands of small children who have been hugely disappointed when they were taken to see the Leonardo da Vinci cartoons at the National Gallery in London.
Yes, I understand that. In fact, yeah, there must have been a lot of people confused. Yeah, like, it's a lot of Renaissance cartoons. That's a normal thing. In the 1840s, there were some cartoons in the traditional sense in the Palace of Westminster, and Punch magazine made a satire, a visual satire about that. And then because the cartoons were in the satire, somehow it became known as the cartoon. Wow. And then they became known as cartoonists. So that's where it comes from. And then we have, you know, it's developed into the what we have today.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
I think it's fantastic that the art made by these guys, and it is art, hit a nerve at the time, really took off and has survived and is still looked at and talked about and is seen as important in a way that much of the straight art, the oil paintings or whatever, made by many of their more worthy contemporaries, hasn't.
You can collect these prints, though. I mean, there's so many of them that you can just go buy them. I could go out into the shop in Covent Garden and I could buy one right now. I could buy a Gilray, a couple of £100, something like that. It's quite cool.
Yeah, Ian Hislop, editor of Private Eye magazine, was my guest talking about George III. And he told me after our chat that he owns, I think, 3 Gilray prints. Have you bought any, Alice?
Yeah, I've got a few. But you can buy original ones. I mean, the one that I've got, it's got really torn edges. So for elites, kind of consumers of Gilrayic prints, they wouldn't like the torn edges. You know, it's all very rough. I didn't really mind
but
that.
But for you to have that connection with the person you're writing about, that's...
But, you know, anyone could do that. And
that's much more important than whether it's got frayed edges.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, all the best things in life have frayed edges. you have to see my flat. There's a lot of frayed edges in here.
So the three main figures in your book, Rowlandson, Gilray and Cruikshank, they were all contemporaries, all living and working close to each other, all vying with each other, I guess trying to top each other. And we have something of a golden age, a bit like the YBAs in 1990s London, perhaps. But what happens to them?
In the 1810s, it all falls apart. Almost the same time as King George III goes mad and suffers from mental illness and is off the scene and the regency properly begins, Gilray also faces madness, and there is these tragic scenes of him trying to commit suicide. Some of the artists who are so brilliant, these brilliant young creatives, they drink themselves to death. Isaac Cruikshank dies because he has a drinking competition. And everyone says, well, at least he won. He definitely won the competition. But yeah, so it kind of ends in this tragic way. And Gilray dies a few weeks before Waterloo. So no one talks about it because in the news, that's not the important thing. The big thing is Waterloo. And it's amazing to think what Gilray would have said about Waterloo, actually, because obviously he'd have had some big hot take on it. They kind of fizzle out at the end. It all fizzles out. And I don't think it's really fizzled back in.
Yeah, I can't think of any Victorian equivalents. I guess the more genteel and jolly likes of Punch magazine took over.
I think there was this kind of change of mood in that if the 1790s was this like crazy drunk party where it's really fun and people making lewd jokes and, you know, people were living life to the full. By the 1820s, there was a change in moral kind of outlook. And actually it was like you know, when you wake up hungover and you look back and you're like, actually, it wasn't that funny. And actually, it's not as tasteful as I thought it was last night. And actually, maybe we should be a bit more wholesome and family friendly. And then the Victorian era dawns.
Yes, very different.
I think the Victorians did a lot to kind of cancel the satirists of the Georgian age.
Yeah.
And so I think we haven't really come out of that.
And I guess most people in Britain wouldn't necessarily recognise their names. Whereas someone like Hogarth, who can very much be seen as their predecessor in this area. Well, I mean, he's got a roundabout named after him.
Well, Hogarth's interesting because he was a painter as well. People call him the father of English painting. That's because people just perceive painting as being real art, and they perceive printmaking as something that's not real. You know, and it's today we look at great paintings and they, you know, Hogarth paintings are hanging in the National Gallery and there's only one of them because it's a painting. Whereas the problem with printmaking is there are lots of versions of all of them, which reduces being this really kind of exclusive thing. And printmakers today, I was talking at the London Print Fair and I was saying in this, all the printmakers today are saying, no one takes us seriously as artists because we do it on bits of paper. But actually, you know, we still have that problem. But that's why Hogarth is in the history of art and Gilray isn't considered as important, I think.
Well, it's a great shame. But luckily we have things like your book Uproar.
Yeah.
To redress the balance. And I greatly recommend it to anyone who's interested not only in these scurrilous printmakers, but also in getting an alternative view of Georgian history. And you know, the grimy, sweaty, ratty picture of high society presented in these prints and in your book, I mean, it's very different to Bridgerton and Queen Charlotte.
Yeah, Pride and Prejudice. I know, it's fun. The thing is, it's really fun and it's silly and it's funny. And you see this kind of way of looking at the Georgian age, which I never had seen until perhaps quite late, when I just imagined it was drawing rooms and, you know, white dresses and that kind of thing and horses and big country houses. But actually, it's this really, really fun and funny and silly world that I think...
Yeah, and everybody's sort of grubby and unkempt and taking dumps in the street and things. It's
much more appealing to modern audiences, perhaps.
I hope that they do make a film of this, and I hope that they have it in keeping with the engravings, that we see all that sort of great bustle of earthy human life.
Well, you'll have to be in the film, Charlie. Who would you like to play?
You could be
Gilray, if you like.
Some terrible, pox-ridden old aristocrat.
Yeah, all that.
That was brilliant. Thank you so much for being my guest, Alice. Well, I suppose I should just ask, are you working on another book?
I am. I'm working on a book which is coming out in August called 18, and it's all about a history of Britain through the lives of its 18-year-olds. So...
Oh, that's
looking
brilliant.
At 18 different 18-year-olds throughout British history and just seeing what they're
teenagers
up to.
Teenagers through the ages.
Yeah, teenagers through the ages. Yeah, that phrase is going to be thrown around a lot in the next few months, I could tell.
Although, the phrase and the concept, I mean, that only sort of came about in the 50s.
Well, exactly. So the whole point is that 18 is this cutoff point we have today where you're suddenly an adult. And that's totally arbitrary because obviously... Over the ages, you know, 12 was often an age where people became an adult, or you know, people have done such crazy things, like being in charge of Italy, right, before the age of 18.
Yeah, I know. I mean, that's the extraordinary thing that I've found making this series, particularly with the sort of medieval period, is just how young everybody was when they did all the things that they're sort of famous for, and you know, the old school history books, and one's image of them is that they're sort of middle-aged men with big
a big beard. Yeah.
They're all kids.
They were all 18 once. I know. That's like, I've always thought about that. So, yeah, that's the what I kind of tried to
Oh, well, brilliant. Well, I will definitely be buying that when that comes out, Alex.
Cool.
And, you know, depending on when you're listening to this podcast, that may already be out. As I say, thank you so much.
No, thanks so much for having
Alice,
me.
Alice, I'm glad we finally got
around
to it.
I know. It's been really great fun. Thanks so much, Charlie.
Cheers. That was Alice Loxton, and to remind you, her book on the Georgian satirists is called Uproar. Make sure you join me on the next episode where we look at another aspect of Georgian society and Georgian history before moving on to King George IV, who in his regency days was a prime target for the likes of Gilray. Follow the podcast now to make sure you don't miss a single episode. Willy Willy Harry Stee was written and presented by me, Charlie Higson, with music by Tom Jenkins and production by Mark Jeeves. Willy Willy Harry Stee, the podcast, is the copyright of Charlie Higson, 2024.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Welcome back to Two Judgy Girls. I'm Mary from the Bay.
And I'm Courtney from LA. TJG is the podcast where we spill all the tea on your favorite reality TV shows, celebrity gossip, and everything in between. We're here to bring you our unfiltered opinions, hilarious commentary, and plenty of laughs along the way.
We're two SDSU Delta Gamma sisters with a microphone and a whole lot of opinions. Each week, we dive headfirst into the wild world of reality television, from Bravo to all the trash TV you could want. We break down the drama, dissect the latest scandals, and share our thoughts on everything from the jaw-dropping moments to the embarrassing antics.
But that's not all. We're not here to just gossip. We're here to connect with you, the jurors, and share our love of all things pop culture. Whether we're dishing on the latest celebrity breakups, discussing our favorite guilty pleasure movies, or sharing embarrassing stories from our own lives, we promise to keep it real, keep it fun, and keep you coming back for more.
Come judge with us.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.